Moses climbed Mount Nebo, wherever exactly that was, we don't know, but somewhere in that area. Moses climbed Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab to the top of Pisgah across from Jericho. And that helps us position because we do know where Jericho was. And it was there that the Lord showed him the whole land from Gilead to Dan. That would be the extent to the north. All of Naphtali, the territory of Ephraim, a little bit closer in Manasseh. All the land of Judah, that would be directly as he looked westward. The land of Judah as far as the western sea, you know, almost over to the Mediterranean. Then to his left, the Negev, and the whole region from the valley of Jericho, the city of palms, as far as Zoar. It's a wonderful view, it really is. And then the Lord said to him, "This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, when I said, I will give it to your descendants. I've let you see it with your eyes, but you won't cross over into it." And Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab. And the Lord has, as the Lord had said, and he, this is God, buried him in Moab, in the valley opposite Beit Peor. But to this day, no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, though his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. The Israelites grieved for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days until the time of weeping and mourning was over. Now Joshua, son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands on him. So the Israelites listened to him, and they did what the Lord had commanded Moses. And now here's this epitaph, in a way, of Moses. "Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face." An amazing statement. "Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all those miraculous signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh, to all his officials, and to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power, performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all of Israel." Now, John 1, just so you know, Gospel of John, including John 1, is going to make some comparisons of Jesus, if you will, as the new Moses. He's subtle about it. He doesn't quite use those words, but it's very similar. So John 1, starting with verse 14, you can keep an eye and an ear out for this comparison with Moses. It's subtle, but it's there. "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, John, that's John the Baptist, of course. John testifies concerning him, and he cries out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was actually before me. From the fullness of his grace, we have all received." Now, I know it says here, one blessing after another. I'm okay with that. It's literally, we have all received grace upon grace. That's literally what it says. We've received grace upon grace. You see, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. And obviously, that's Jesus that is being referred to here, though it says, God, the one and only, that the Father's side has made him known. Lord, these are profound pictures and insights. Help us to taste them and make them part of us. In him, amen. I'm a bit of a student of media. I don't like much of what comes on media. No, you don't either. I'm interested in many ways in the effect media are having on society, though not all of it is bad. It certainly is some of that as well. I'm interested in the way, as the late Marshall McLuhan, I hope you know that well-known Canadian, University of Toronto, as the late Marshall McLuhan used to say of media, we use tools, but the tools change us. I'm sure he's not always right, but he's got a lot of insight there, and I was deeply influenced by him since I was fairly young. And so I'm intrigued in just looking at media and seeing the environment that they create. And I'm fascinated with the way people become famous. All right? People have various ways to become famous. There are some who have that, what I call celebrity shtick. They just have this ability, even if they haven't really done that much, to be able to call the right sources. And literally, there are famous men and women, media icons, who can call up the right media connections and say, so-and-so, they're referring to themselves, so-and-so is going to walk from their condominium to their car at such and such a time, and they know the media are going to be there to film them. You know, I try that. Nobody shows up. But some people do that with great success. Some people are famous because they have done heroic acts. I think good for them. Once in a while, people accidentally just find themselves in a position to do something amazing. They become famous. Sometimes people just by force of personality, maybe good personality or not good personality, but just the force of their personality have them in the media. They're famous. Can you think of any Americans who would be like that? I don't know. Sometimes people have just legendary leadership and people just want to follow them. And sometimes it's just accidents of circumstance. You're in the right place, right time, or wrong place, wrong time, and you become famous. And I was thinking back as I was reflecting on Deuteronomy 34, do people ever get propelled into fame because they're wise, because they're recognized as deep people? And I think occasionally it happens, although not in the media environment we have right now. But I am convinced that Moses, at least in many, many Jewish circles, ironically, he's being forgotten or virtually forgotten in so many evangelical Christian circles, because he's perceived as, that guy way back there, we're interested only in Jesus. But at least in Jewish circles, he has a kind of fame, as he rightly should, and very specifically because of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the people who helped affirm this, not the one who created it, but was another rather famous Jew of the 12th century, Rabbi Moses ben Maimonides, also known as Rambam. And he was a Jewish-Spanish philosopher, but often well known for his wonderful knowledge of the law. By the way, you may not think you've heard of Rambam or Maimonides, but I'm going to give you two quotes, and I bet you've heard at least one of these quotes, okay? He is the guy who said once, we're going back 900 years, the risk of the wrong decision is preferable to the terror of indecision. That's Maimonides. Now, if you don't know that one, this next one, I'm almost positive you've heard. Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Yeah, you've heard the rest of that, haven't you? Teach a man to fish and you feed him for life. You've probably heard that in a missions setting and know of it as sort of a maxim of missions work. And that's fine, nothing wrong with that. But that was originally said by Maimonides. And that's the kind of wisdom. Anyway, here's a wise man. I almost said wise guy. I don't know if he was that, but a wise man. But he says Moses is, quote, the greatest. Not one of the greatest, but the greatest of the prophets. And I'm simply asking why. And I don't know, it's a surprise that you hear, but why? Let's be specific. It is because of something that I want to just open up a little bit with you face to face. It's called the phrase face to face here. So I'm going to start, however, with a concept. And the concept is one that I generally avoid using because it sounds too jargonish, even though it's not. It just sounds it. It's the concept of covenant love. So one of these phrases that some of my friends and I call biblish, okay? It's wording where you know it's in the Bible, but because it's so familiar, it's so easy just to move past it. But it really is a great thought. It's about the idea that God brings people into a relationship with Him first, and then teaches them how to know and love Him. All right? Did you catch the order here? Not that He develops the relationship and then sort of finally they arrive. It doesn't work that way. And we know, in fact, as you look at various people in the Bible, God brought some pretty ragged people into relationship with Him when they were still ragged. We don't know much about them. We see their development afterwards. He brings them into relationship and teaches them how to love Him. It's this idea we were looking at this morning from Psalm 139, right? God knew people long before they knew Him, right? He knew them from the beginning. God chose people long before they had a chance to prove themselves from their performance. By the way, in addition, God's plans with the people that He has brought into relationship span a stunning amount of time. I don't know if you realize this, but when we read Deuteronomy 34, and then we moved on to John, we were looking from Abraham to Moses. You know, God divulges these plans to Abraham, makes them concrete under Moses, a span of something like 600 to 700 years. That's amazing. 600 to 700 years. It's a long time. And yet that's the level at which He's operating, bringing one person in a relationship and then sort of carrying through with the deal that spans countless lifetimes in the middle. Anyway, covenant love is brilliant because one of the things it does is it bypasses what I call our human flakiness. I don't know about you. I'm just going to ask you can answer this to yourself. Do you not have days when truly you feel very spiritual and well-grounded, back-to-back sometimes with days where your heart feels about as cold as an ice cube? You ever have those kind of things, back-to-back? And you can't explain it? Maybe nothing in particular happened. You just say, boy, what my mind was here and where it is here, they don't seem to have any connection. You know, that's a reflection of our flakiness, you know, whatever the particulars are. And the fact that we're looking at God's covenant love says God's consistency is our security. It certainly isn't ourselves. By the way, back when I was a young Christian, this is what drove me into the arms of a doctrine that for years I detested. I was very open about my contempt for predestination, any idea of predestination. I thought, no one's going to manipulate me. That was my attitude. I was arrogant, very presumptuous. And then the more I got acquainted with that flakiness, I thought, I don't want to be the one who's the grounds for my salvation. I'm too unreliable. Anyway, back to covenant love. So covenant love circumvents that. Or as 1 John 4:19 puts it, we love because He first loved us. And if we're seeking Him, it's because He first sought us. You know, Adam, where are you? And that was just the beginning of God seeking for us. Now you say, okay, what does that have to do with Moses? And what does this have to do with knowing? Well, let's come back to our passage here, Deuteronomy 34. Moses' epitaph, I want to just reread a couple lines of it, verses 10 and 11, okay? No prophet has risen in Israel like Moses. In other words, his fame is this unique role he has, okay? Whom the Lord knew face to face, okay? And elsewhere, you know, Moses is called the servant of Yahweh, the servant of the Lord. What a wonderful label to be known by. I'm His servant, all right? That's covenant love, that relationship. And for all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform, and we know those stories very well. We learned them as children. He's known for those stunning miracles, that sequence of 10, among others, that brought his people out of Israel. And then it's this next piece. It's this next piece I want to bring you to. And he was someone who knew God face to face. Now, we talked this morning about knowing, right? We generally are people, we want to be known. We are born with a natural curiosity to know, right? You don't train a toddler to be curious. You just wait till they're mobile and they'll be ripping apart stuff. Trust me, they're curious. They want to know. They want to experience. That's good. God made us that way. All right. But our curiosity in wanting to know and our curiosity and desire to be known are God-given gifts because they're part of our development and our yearning, at least if we'll encourage them and be open to them, which bring us not only into a connection with the world around us, but in a connection with the God who made us. In other words, there is this hunger for God that human beings can have, so I say this cautiously, almost naturally. It's what Pascal called that God-shaped vacuum inside of us that wants to have something transcendent, something bigger than we are, something greater than we are, something more magnificent and more consistent than the world in which we live. And that's what we're looking at here. Now, look, Moses had it made. You know the stories. I'm just drawing on your knowledge of Moses. Moses had it made, right? He doesn't choose to be in the royal court. He's brought up in the royal court. In fact, he's not exactly young when he starts to see things differently. He's 40, right? And he realizes for all that he has, the education he has, the privileges of the court, the wealth, the food, the everything, something's wrong. And you start to see this development in him, this conviction. There is something terribly wrong with this whole picture of society that's before him with those in privilege and those who were enslaved. And it doesn't stop there, you see. He develops. He starts to be illuminated. You know, he takes a preemptive move. Now he has to run. All right, you think the story's over. If you're reading it for the first time, he runs, he's hiding, he gets married in the wilderness, and you figure it's all over. Oh, but it's not over. That annoying bush that's burning but not being consumed. Ah, now he gets to be illuminated. Here's God's name. He starts to know God in a way he had never known before. I'm not going to say he's not a believer. I don't know that. I'm just saying he's illuminated in a way that is unlike anything else. And so much that he will go back. Can you imagine this? He's going to go back to the last place he wants to go back to. Because he has been running for decades. But he goes back. That's a man of deep conviction. He's energized to verbally wrestle with the most powerful man he had ever known, most powerful man any of us would have known if we'd been at that time, the Pharaoh himself. By the way, Pharaoh, the Egyptian word for Pharaoh literally is the big house. That's the Egyptian word for Pharaoh, the big house. All right? Isn't that a great, great label? Okay? The big house. All right? He's energized to wrestle and let my people go. Let them at least worship. Okay? If you won't let them at least worship, this plays out over time. Then we're heading out anyway, and all these things unleash. And then in Exodus 12 and following, he now is set on the third 40-year block of his working life. Right? 40 plus 40 plus 40. Most of us think about retiring after about one 40-year block of work. He's on number three at that point. And the best and the worst are yet to come. They're both there. The point I'm getting is, because we're familiar with the stories, we say, that's the way it happened, and it did. But you realize people get brought to these points. They don't just get them. They get brought to it. And they get affirmed in it. And I'm still asking, how does that happen? Well, I'm back to this phrase. He knew God face to face. This term and one similar to it keep showing up at various points in the story of Moses. To know God face to face. Now, you know, when we say face to face, it means I'm face to face with you now. I'm looking at your face. You're looking at my face. Okay. There's a place. That's part of the meaning. But there's more going on here. God, this is Exodus 33:11. God would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Now think about this. How do you speak to a friend? I'm sure there's a variety of answers you have for that. But one of them perhaps is my good friend that I, you know, you would say I speak with, is someone where when there's just something occupying my mind that I just can't shake, I can go to that friend and say, hey, can we just sit and chat for a while? And it's not only that you're physically face-to-face with them, which you are, okay, but you open up your heart and you converse. And they respond to you, not dictatorially, but heart-to-heart. And the conversing back and forth is what is so precious with a good friend. That's face-to-face. That's what's meant here. Let me quote another piece. This is Numbers 12. This time, this is God speaking. Okay? This is Numbers 12:8. I speak with Moses mouth to mouth, openly, not in dark conversation. He sees the form of God. Now, the way Exodus helps us get that is Moses wants to know God in an open way. God does not permit face-to-face in the most literal sense. Moses never gets to say, I stood there, God stood there, and I saw all of his glory. You couldn't survive that. He doesn't get to see that. The Bible's clear on that. But God lets Moses see him. This is the image for us, as if he's looking at the back of God. Pretty close. That's what makes Moses extraordinary. And something I had missed until just a few months ago when I was restudying this. Do you know, when these kinds of interactions with Moses and God would take place, in some of them at least, there is an observer. I missed this for years. Maybe you probably can figure out who the observer is. The observer is Joshua. And I wonder, what effect did that have on Joshua? Is that the kind of thing you want to go out and talk about? Right? Okay, you never guess what I saw today. You know? Or is it the kind of thing where you're forever afraid to talk about it because it is so profound? You just realize, I've just got to tuck this away and just walk with it discreetly. Anyway, so there's Moses with God face to face. Okay? It's not the visual, though he gets little visuals, but it's the conversational, the personal. In other words, if I could put some words cautiously in Moses' mouth, he could say, I've known God. I've been known by God, sure, but I've known God in some ways others maybe haven't. And I would think for the kind of calling that he had, he needed that. These are tough people to deal with. Tough, tough people, really. And then, now let's bring in John 1 momentarily, okay? Great as Moses was, Jesus, even more unique. He can say not only I've known God, he does say that, and I know God, he does say that, but he actually came from God. That's something Moses never could say. Jesus could say, I came from God. John 1:14 says he came from God. He existed before with God, and then he makes his tent temporarily in our midst. Comes from God, all right? And that he knew God personally, knowing the grace and truth that God has, but not just knowing it, he actually embodies the grace and truth. And that little phrase that I had to sort of, if you will, correct just to be clear on something, grace upon grace, the little word that we translate upon actually doesn't literally mean upon. You know, upon is like on top of something. And the Greek word upon, epi, very, very similar. But that's not the word that's there. The word is anti, not anti in the sense of against as an enemy, but anti in the sense of right opposite the other. It's this face-to-face thing. It's like grace face-to-face with grace. For I don't know how else to express it. Nobody else does either, by the way. Okay? But grace, face-to-face with the grace. So much grace, you don't know what to do with it. And that's Jesus, not Moses. And that's why John says of Jesus, he has seen and he has explained God to us. These are the profound things of knowing God face-to-face, which Moses has. Jesus, all the more. I think for us knowing God, well, it's being overwhelmed by these things. Knowing the facts is a great place to start, not a good place to end, but they become so much a part of you. Experience, presence of God, more and more part of you, you start to just be different, right? You ever have a good friend where this person was just such a good friend and they had so much to offer, you realize this friendship is, in a good way, changing my life. Many of us would say we've had good friends like that. So that's a tiny taste of being friends face to face with God, being changed, not being the same, being overwhelmed by grace and truth. And you know, and this is my final very short piece here, knowing God, we get to have some of this in worship, right? But knowing God is also, as Jesus said, you know, there's the two pieces of the law. There's knowing God, and there is loving your brother, huh? So part of knowing God is time with God. That doesn't surprise us. But there's a part of knowing God which says, if this is real over here, if this worship is real right here, if your time with God privately is real right there, then it has to be over life service that you start to work it out and make it concrete. So that people looking at your life may, if they're honest, can say, you're giving them a taste of eternity in heaven, right? So worship of God involves life service. Knowing God, at least in a way, is like knowing others. The way you get to know others is through all the casual, well, study times and together times with others to know them, but also then give a little taste of the taste of grace God has given you. Friends, life is short. I'm an optimist. I have two great aunts that lived respectively to 104 and 106. I'm an optimist, okay? But even if it lasts that long, and I don't have that much confidence that it will, I'm just saying life is short. It comes and goes. And this week, it's reasonable to guess, each of us is going to be given some limited opportunities to draw from your knowledge of God, your experience with God, your soul and spirit before His Spirit, and to act on it and to show it and to be generous with it, to be encouraging with it. May you have the strength, may I have the strength to do those things well. Father, please allow us to do exactly that. We pray in Jesus' name, who was with you, was before you, was face to face with you, and much as you gave Moses, how much more through Jesus and in Jesus we have.